Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and as always, I'm so glad you're able to join me for a little while today as we go combing through the boxes and binders and stacks of cards that you have in your collection, or better yet, in my collection. That's what kind of started this whole podcast many years ago. And today we're going to be talking about something that started a revolution in the hobby. And you've heard the saying, the revolution will be televised. And it's so funny, it's kind of an old saying now. It's not even revolutionary to say the revolution will be televised. But what was the catchphrase for many college punk bands and REM songs turns out to be something that actually did happen in the late 1980s. No, it wasn't televised. However, there was a major, major revolution in the hobby back then. And it's so funny with revolutions, because sometimes you know they're coming, other times it's not as obvious. And I was thinking back to some revolutions in especially a lot of the technical stuff these days, technology that is. When you think back to revolutions that came right out, had the spotlight on it, everybody knew it was going to be a hit. You know, I think back to when the iPhone was unveiled back in the summer of 2007. That was a seminal moment in not only technological history and business and marketing history, but it was also a huge moment in society. Our lives are 180 degrees different now than, say, 15 years ago before the iPhone or similar technology came out. Now, of course, you can argue there's good and bad with that, but no doubt about it, when Steve Jobs unveiled the iPhone back in 2007, everything changed. And in terms of mobile phones and the content that goes on them, everything has changed since. And it continues to change. It continues to evolve, but you can go back to that one moment when it was unveiled and people are lining up down the block to get an iPhone. That was a big revolutionary moment. And likewise, and again, a lot of it comes to technology, at least the first few examples I could think of, but going back to when Windows 95 was unveiled, if you're old enough to remember that, remember the hook to the Rolling Stones' Start Me Up being used to advertise the unveiling of Windows 95. That was back in, September of 1995. And like the iPhone, when Bill Gates and company come out on stage and they unveil all the tricks that Windows 95 can do, all of a sudden, personal computing changed overnight. And yeah, there were some bits and pieces of what would become Windows 95. You would see it in, you know, previous editions of Windows operating system, and you'd see a little bit of it in the Mac system. But Windows 95, because of how it was promoted and how it was launched, it was an instant hit. And again, everything we do now with personal computing and, you know, by extension, the internet, because that's just when, you know, using the personal computer for internet usage was starting to spike. Life is completely different before and after Windows 95 was unveiled. And, you know, a more modern example would be like Disney Plus. You know, you could use other examples too, like Netflix or Amazon Prime. And when these services roll out, it's a big deal at that time. Well, sometimes there are revolutions that are often overlooked or don't just scream and jump right out at you and go, hey, this is something new and exciting. It's going to change the world. In fact, there's some pretty notable examples of that methodology of a revolution. And again, kind of thinking of the technology side, that's just the first one that came to mind. But looking at, Facebook. Facebook is a great example of, you know, a service, a website, a product, if you will, that the premise of it was pretty good. And of course, it was coming around after MySpace came around. It came out well after chat rooms on the internet. But Facebook eventually became the model of what is called social media. And our lives are completely different before and after Facebook. And again, there's good and bad with that. But, you know, another example is Twitter, and a non-technological example, there we go, that I can think of is like Southwest Airlines. You know, the concept of this small regional airline just going, you know, hopping from one dot to the other on the map and eventually becoming this behemoth of an airline in America that still, for the most part, sticks to the model it created 50 years ago and was worlds apart different from what the rest of the airline industry was in the 1970s and 1980s. That, again, is one of those revolutions where, you know, the concept at first is a good idea, but I don't think anybody other than the creators of the airline, I don't think anybody ever imagined that the idea of doing a short-haul airline business would make more sense than compared to, again, what was already well established in the 1950s and 1960s. So my point with all these examples is you've got some revolutions that there's a big announcement. Hey, this is coming. Here we go. And then there are other revolutions that happen that just happen. And for whatever reasons, it eventually grows into a game-changing event. And the revolution in the hobby that we're talking about is 1989 Upper Deck. This is something, as we'll get into, there were bits and pieces of what Upper Deck would become in 1989 when it debuted that were already out there in the baseball card hobby. And there was some promotion and some announcement, and there was some thought of, hey, this is going to be new and different. But I don't think anyone realized in 1989 how earth-shattering, how different, how, you know, changing the introduction of Upper Deck would be to the hobby. As the introduction of Upper Deck would push the hobby from being a hobby to almost 100% business, and how it would change the hobby to where just putting out a fun stack of baseball cards with a piece of gum or a sticker in it wasn't good enough anymore. And within 3 years, everybody had upped their game to a premium product, less toys, more pricey stuff. Now, again, there's good and bad with that. The good is you've got this really cool product coming out, not just from Upper Deck, but the trickle-down effect, how everybody else had to create something that could compete with it. The bad side, of course, is it drove prices up, often drove younger people or people on limited incomes out. This is happening at the same time as the video game revolution. Again, you know, think about the introduction of the Nintendo gaming system or the Sega Genesis system back in the early 1990s. So these two worlds are colliding here. So younger people or people who wanted a better return on their investment, rather than spend $200 on baseball cards that would depreciate in value as it would turn out in 5 years, spend $200 on a gaming system and just sit down in front of the TV and play Super Mario Brothers or what have you. That just, again, changed here. I don't think anybody realized the good and the bad that would come out of this. And certainly the founders of the Upper Deck Company as well, as we'll get a little into the story later on. And by the way, if you go back through our archives, I do give a complete history of Upper Deck. Back in episode 28, way, way, way back in October of 2016, we got around to the 89 Upper Deck set. And I will give an abbreviated version later on in the program. But again, it really was a paradigm-shifting moment in hobby history that, other than the initial investors, I don't think anybody ever imagined the impact, both positive and negative, that the 1989 Upper Deck set and then subsequent sets would have in the baseball card world. So we'll discuss that in this program. We'll also randomly select four cards from the packs that I opened up. If you saw our video link, You know that I've got plenty of checklist cards, no Ken Griffey Jr. rookie cards, unfortunately. But if you want to check out the video link, if you haven't already seen the link in our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains, just go onto YouTube, type in Wax Ecstatic 1989 Upper Deck Baseball Break, and you will see me open up these glistening packs of 89 Upper Deck. And they are a little pricier than the other stuff that's out there, but again, there's a good reason for it, and we'll break that down a little later on in the program. Now, Wax Ecstatic comes your way every other Friday here via Audio Boom and all the other channels that grab the RSS feed, including Apple Podcasts, not Apple Piecast. I've had too much Apple Piecast during the holidays here. I am fighting to keep the pounds off because of all these damn Christmas cookies that have just ended up in my house. Like a flock of seagulls or other bad 80s bands. No, like a the swallows at Capistrano coming in to roost every year. There's way too many Christmas cookies hanging around here, and I got to get rid of them. So no Apple Piecast, but Apple Podcasts, however, also were picked up by iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, Google Play, Spotify, and numerous others. Again, they grab onto that RSS feed and send it out your way every Friday, or every other Friday, excuse me, at noon Eastern. Now, yes, we are in the middle of the holidays, but I do plan on having a show on January 2nd. So we'll find a way to get that done. And hopefully we'll have some neat little toys to pick up at the upcoming card show here in my hometown of Tampa, Florida, as we'll go searching through the bargain bins and see what kind of fun things we can pick up and share with you in a couple of weeks. Now, I mentioned the Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains had some great listener response to our last show on the grocery cards, as I like to call them, the breakfast cereal cards from the 1960s on up. And also, you know, speaking of bargain bins, I was able to share with you a few of the cards that I picked up from the 1930s and 40s at a recent show. So we had a lot of great listener reaction to that, as well as some questions based on the idea of a birth year set collection. So we'll get to that, and also the 89 Upper Deck set as well. And also, we've gotten some great response from our listeners helping keep the program alive with cash donations through our PayPal account. That is paypal.me/waxecstatic. My thanks to Nathan McNeely for contributing once again. You know, Nathan is almost single-handedly keeping you from having to listen to the 89 Bowman rack opening or the 90 Donruss wax pack opening. I still have those in hand just in case the donations dry up. But boy, talk about the other end of the spectrum from 89 Upper Deck. Yeah, 89 Bowman would definitely qualify for that. But Nathan, again, with a nice contribution. Thank you very much. Also, from Marcia Skoback, thank you so much for your contribution as well. And if you still have a few dollars left from your Christmas and holiday spending and you would like to gift us a cash donation, you can do so again at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Now, those donations come back into the program, not my own pocket. They go right back to the show, right back for your entertainment, 100%. And it goes back in two ways. One, we buy the products with the cash that you donate. So the stuff that we talk about, we do that with your cash donations. So I can, without batting an eye, go out and buy some 89 Upper Deck and go scour through the boxes at a local card show to see what we can find. Thanks again to those contributions. And also, any cards that we have left over, the dupes, if you will, the excess product, we will donate to Commons for Kids, who do a great job in collecting common sports cards from all years, all makes and models, and they will collate these cards and donate them to kids in hospitals or kids who don't have a whole lot of spending money or kids who are just having a tough time. These are nice little gifts that go out to the kids that need a distraction from life. And what better distraction than a handful of baseball cards, old and new, commons and star cards, rookies and veterans, and being able to put the hobby in kids' hands, regardless of their situation, is always a good thing. It keeps kids linked up with the hobby, also with a great sport of baseball or other sports if you donate other cards, and it also keeps them out of trouble. So it's not just lifting up spirits, it's keeping kids in a good spot here. So we're very happy every few months to donate the extra cards that we get through the purchases to Commons for Kids. Now, the other way that we use your dollars is right back into the program in terms of the technical side. We do have to pay Audio Boom an annual fee every year to keep not only the new shows coming, but also keep the archive alive and well. And we've got a ton of shows in our collection here. What was the last episode? I believe 146 now? Yeah, 146 episodes. This will be 147 if you don't include a bonus survey episode we did a couple years ago. And we could slap a price tag on some of these older shows, but I prefer not to. I would like to work on just the donations of the generous. So even if it's $5 or if it's $50 or it's somewhere in between, every dollar goes a long way through your contribution, not only keeping this show up and running and keeping the archives free and open for anyone to listen to or download, but also in purchasing the product and, again, passing along that product in a secondhand form to the Commons for Kids people. So a lot of great reasons to donate. Even, again, if it's just a few bucks, every dollar goes a very long way. Because I'm a thrifty host, that's not cheap. I'm looking for the best return on investment, but I will try to get the best bang for the buck with everything that is donated. Now let's take a look back at the last episode talking about the breakfast cereal cards, the grocery cards. A lot of people really enjoyed the program here and looking back through their own collection, including Al Zervik, who was wondering about the Nestle cards from 1984. We had one with Tim Raines, and he says, I have some of these in near mint condition. How to price? Well, there are some reputable online price guides here, but I think a rule of thumb is basically just keep it about a dollar or two. And really, it's just going to be the market that determines the price tag for it, considering these are from 1984, not exactly 1964. It's going to kind of pretty much fall into a general price range. Really no $100 cards in that particular set, except for that one card that I was talking about, the panel card featuring a couple of players that I believe came off a box of cards, and it wasn't exactly a promotional card. So other than that one particular panel card that is out there, most of those Nestle cards are worth a few bucks. But they are pretty sharp, and if they're in near mint condition, if you're able to cobble together an entire set, you should be able to turn it around relatively easily for maybe about $30 or $35. Like I said, if you kind of use that $1 to $2 price range for most of those cards. Also adding to the discussion, Topper Dan says, I found all sorts of grocery cards I forgot I had, like this beauty. And he shares this picture of the Jumbo Sunflower Seeds Randy Johnson card. Now, it mentions Seattle Mariners, so that means it was approved of by Major League or by the Players Association, but you don't have any Mariners word marks here. You don't have the logo on here. Those are the grocery cards I didn't like. And I can also tell by the color scheme of Johnson's hat here, this was at least 1993. So this was well in the thick of things of companies that were just kind of overdoing the baseball card production back in the 1990s. And I've shared the stories with you before of, you know, my post baseball cards from the 90s that weren't nearly as good as what was put out in the 60s or 70s. Same can be said for the Ziploc cards and all the other cards that were just being mass produced because baseball cards were such a thing in the early 90s. Everybody had to have their own model of it. Also adding to the conversation here from Topper Dan, I recall Mother's Cookies had Griffey cards in their products in 89. Not sure if it was just in the Pacific Northwest. Well, I haven't seen the Mother's Cookies cards, Dan, but I do know that depending on the maker of them, there may be some more regional cards. Now, that would also add to a little bit of the value of some of these cards. Not a whole lot. Again, we're talking 1989. But if it is Ken Griffey and if it is more of a regional product that was putting this out, Then again, depending on what the market will bear, you may be able to get it for a few more dollars than, say, your 1995-ish Randy Johnson sunflower seed card. Nathan McNeely adding, you ain't kidding, everyone made baseball cards in the 80s. My dad worked for Quaker Oats for about 30 years. Accordingly, I'm 30% granola and have a towering stack of 1986 Quaker Oats baseball cards somewhere. Might be holding up your roof if it's truly a towering stack. And one good thing, too, about the 30% of being oats in your body there, you've always got a source of protein, so that's a good thing. The Quaker Oats cards of the 1980s, I've seen a few of those. I may actually have some buried in my collection as well, not holding up the roof, but I think that there is slightly a little more premium on those simply because they were released in the mid-80s before the absolute paranoia and fever of the baseball card mania in the early 1990s. Then again, since you have a stack of those somewhere, you may have just admitted to depressing the market just a little bit. So be careful who you tell that you have a whole stack of these cards laying around somewhere. John Grochowski bringing up a fun little set here that I actually do recall, and I may have one of these cards somewhere buried in my collection, or maybe I got rid of it years ago. But John says, just listen to this great podcast and have me thinking about the cards that Big League Chew put in their pouches and did a little research. There were 1986 Home Run Legends, a real sharp 12-card set. And I have seen those cards before, even though they didn't quite grab your attention like one of the major manufacturer products of the mid to late 80s. They did stand out. They were very colorful. They were almost, for lack of a better description, they were almost a knockoff of the 75 Topps cards. And I say that in the sense that it was a two-tone card. And that was about it. You know, it didn't have like the big 3D lettering at the top of the card like 75 Topps did, but you definitely had the odd pairing, the complementary pairing of two colors to make the cards stand out in a pretty routine back to the card, if I recall. But if you're into niche little collectibles, and the Home Run collection would have been for members at that time who had 500 or more home runs. Of course, it was only 11 players back then. So my how times have changed with, steroids and other devices such as that. But if you like collecting things featuring Hank Aaron and Babe Ruth and Mickey Mantle and Willie Mays and stuff like that, you could probably find a 12-card subset from Big League Chew for an affordable price out there somewhere. All right, birth years. This was a very interesting question brought up by Topps Pursuit. He said, birth year sets might be an interesting episode theme. We all have a unique emotional bond with the set from the year we were born. Working on the 76 Topps set myself right now, my son just checked off the 08. So I responded that I don't know if I could actually make an entire show out of it, because obviously my birth year is different from a lot of people's birth year. And my birth year set may not mean a hill of beans to your birth year set, although this is our hill and these are our beans. But I did throw the question out there to our listeners, is anybody doing this? And we got a great response from our listeners, including John Grochowski, who said, actually considering doing 1974, I thought if I could hold out, then collect 1974, the same year 1974 Heritage comes out, that would be fun. Well, as long as you don't mind waiting until 2023, John, that could be a fun exercise. Or if you think it might take a while to get the 74 Topps set, maybe you start on the 74 set now, hopefully complete it by the time the 2023 Heritage set comes out that spring. Also, Steve Bowman adding, I built an 80s top set. Took me a couple of years and card shows to finish it. Russ Bear also says, would like to work my way down to 1972, but it gets pricey at 75. Well, it does. So again, there has to be a little bit of a trade-off if you're looking at sets, particularly in the 1970s, because even the mid to late 70s sets, as Topps was looking to save money and they made the card stock a little thinner those years, the cards get banged up a lot easier than some of the cards from the 60s and early 70s. So if you're willing to do the trade-off of, I don't need a PSA 10 set, but if I just get one card of each from the set, regardless of condition, then I'll do it. then it'll be a lot easier to put together a set, and maybe you don't mind having some of those star cards or those rookie cards at, say, a PSA 3 or 4 if it just means getting the set done. So that is kind of the trade-off there. Either you get a mint set, and it takes a lot of time and costs a lot of money, or you just get whatever version of the card you get, and you just kind of live with it. But you're absolutely right about having that connection to your birth year set. And I've mentioned this before with 77 Tops, as 1977 was my birth year. I have always had this unique connection to that set ever since, really, when I started collecting. And I think it was just part of the, when I started collecting, just wondering, what do I collect? And as I started collecting in, 1989, 1990, it was, I don't want to say easier, but it didn't seem that far off to say, oh, the 1977 set is only 12 or 13 years old. So I can find certainly the common cards a lot easier than, say if I was born in the 1950s or what have you. Of course, now the 1977 set, like me, is 42 years old and getting older. So finding the PSA 10 cards are hard. I have not officially started the 1977 set. It is a curious thing that I might do someday because back then the set was only 600, it was more than 660 cards. 692, I want to say, because of the additions of, it was more than 692. Anyways, it was the first year it had grown in a long time because of the addition of the Toronto Blue Jays and Seattle Mariners. But I've always had a connection to that set. And it's not just my birth year, but also because I was a Blue Jay fan as a kid. It was a great connection for me to try to find cards of my favorite baseball team from their first year. So there was some kind of, not really book value that was added to it, but certainly a personal value that was added to it. So that may be something I do someday. I do know off the top of my head, I probably have probably about 150 cards already in various conditions. I also do talk about birth year sets. I have in my collection a handful of unopened wax packs from the 1970s, one each from 74, 75, 76, 78, and 79. And I got a great deal a few years ago on 77 Tops. I think I've got three from 77. And we've already done 77 Tops on the show. I've already opened a pack or two in the history of the program. Maybe I do it again. I don't know. But, that just goes to show the connection with 77, where I went out of my way to find a lot of packs. I want to say it was a 5 or 6 pack lot. Like I said, I got a really good deal from a reputable dealer too. I think I paid maybe a grand total of $40 for these things. I don't know how. I just did. And, they've been fun. The two or three that I've opened, it's a fun thing to open up. But I still have, I think it's three in my collection. And I don't open the other ones just because they're from 77. For whatever reason, I've got to keep them in the wax wrapper. Now, with that said, if you want to make a cash donation to paypal.me/waxecstatic, I could open up a pack and send you the cards. So interesting point there about the birth year sets, and it is something I'd have to go back and just see what cards I have, because you know me, I'm not a big stickler for conditioned cards. So if I can buy a lot of 77 Tops, Lord knows I've found some star cards and superstar cards at these card shows recently, where it's just a dollar or two for even some of the bigger cards, even though they're not in great shape. It's certainly feasible to get that set done for probably just $40 or $50 if I'm not too concerned about, the condition of the cards. So thanks for the suggestion. I may take up that endeavor myself, not right at this moment, but certainly something to consider on down the line. Now, pointing to the direction of our podcast this week on 89 Upper Deck, after I shared a picture of the packs that I was going to open, I did that, I think it was on Monday. No, it was last week, actually, late last week. I shared on Wax and Gum Stains the four packs and said, oh, here we go. This is what we're going to talk about. Kirby Thomas Jr. sent me a note, says, I hope you opine. Love the word opine. Kirby, for you, I will not only opine, I will pontificate. I hope you opine on why the packs slash boxes are so expensive versus a raw Griffey. I know it's the chance of a PSA 10, but $150 a box seems high to me. Are most just being stocked away as investments since these boxes only seem to go up? What's your take? A lot of layers to that onion, Kirby. And first of all, let's talk about why a pack or a box is more valuable than the raw Griffey itself. Now, while card number one, the Ken Griffey Jr. card from 89 Upper Deck, is arguably the most sought after card of the 1980s. And I say arguably because you can put in some of those star and rookie cards from the early 80s. You know who I'm talking about. Your Bonds are not Bonds. I mean, the Bonds rookie is a valuable one too. But the Boggs rookie, the Sandberg, the Ripken, Ricky Henderson, 1980. There are several cards from the early 80s that are highly sought after. But because it's Ken Griffey Jr., and because it's card number one, and because it's the first card from the first set that Upper Deck produced, there is a little more run-up on the market there. So it is arguably the most sought-after card from the 1980s baseball card sets. And that card alone, depending on the grading, depending on how you get your hands on it, depending on who you buy it from, if you're purchasing it secondhand, can cost you upwards of a few hundred dollars easily, again, depending on the method and the grading of it and you name it. So there is a set value for that particular card. So why are the packs and boxes, raised up in value? Well, a couple of things. First of all, because there is, as you pointed out, Kirby, there is that chance that you pull the PSA 10 right out of the pack. Now, does that necessarily make the card more valuable if you pull it fresh from a pack? No, because you still have to go through the PSA or, whoever is doing the grading. You still have to go through the grading process, and there is some time involved and some money involved, and you hope when you get it back it is a PSA 9 or a 10. So does it necessarily make it more valuable? No, but it's the chase that makes it more valuable. Sure, I can go out and get a graded Griffey Jr., and I'm just going to throw a price out there. I'm not saying this is the actual price that it's going for. I could get a graded Griffey Jr. card for $200, let's say. And yeah, that's money well spent. A couple hundred bucks for this big card from a big set. And again, arguably the biggest card of the decade that was ever produced. Or I can chase after it just a little bit. There's the thrill of the chase. So rather than spend $200 on one card that is already found to be worth that value, I could spend $200 on a low series box and rip through 36 packs of cards and hope that I strike gold and get not just one Griffey, but maybe two or three. And that's where the markup is, in particular with boxes, because you've got a set number of packs inside this box. And if you're buying the low number series, you're getting cards 1 through 700, which is why I bought the low number packs, because even though there was a random sequencing with Upper Deck, that was one of their big marketing ploys back then. Even though there was random sequencing, the idea of adding another 100 cards into the sequence, if I bought a high number set or a high number group of packs, kind of a turnoff for me because I'm going for this Griffey card. I don't want the, traded or, I don't want a Nolan Ryan card, even though that one is one of the more valuable high number cards of the set. I'm going for that Griffey, so I want to make the odds as best as possible. So that's why the boxes go for, depending where you're buying them, a couple hundred bucks, because it's not just getting the Griffey. It's not just getting a Griffey. You're hoping that the sequencing works out in your favor to where you get two or three, or if you're really lucky, somehow you end up with like four or five in a box. That would be very unlikely, though, unless that box happened to be packaged during some little hiccup in the sequencing, because the repetition in these packs, even the four that I bought, was few and far between. There wasn't a whole lot that was in there. other than checklist. I've got plenty of checklists in my four packs. And likewise, that's why the packs go for a premium amount as well. The four that I bought, I think with shipping, or not shipping, with taxes, I want to say it was like $21, I think is what I got for four packs. And that's certainly a lot more than what I would pay for any other 1989 baseball card product. That's, you know, what, $5, five and a quarter a pack, which is an awful lot for something from 1989. But again, there's that chance. In four packs, I've got a better chance of pulling a Griffey card than in one pack. So I'm willing to spend that extra money for the chance to get that key card. So sure, you can spend a couple $100 or a few $100 to procure that PSA 9 or that PSA 10 Griffey card from your local card dealer or what have you. Or you can spend that same money and buy either a collection of packs or an entire box. And if you're really lucky, you manage to land at least two of them. Because certainly if you get one, that's the holy grail of baseball cards from the 1980s. But if you somehow end up with two, you've more than paid for your investment if you go through the whole process of getting it graded and then reselling it for what the market says the value of that graded card is. So that's why the 89 Upper Deck packs and boxes are priced at a much higher price. It's so funny because, you know, let's use that price of $150 you bring up, Kirby. You know, you could buy one box of cards from Upper Deck for $150. Likewise, from 1989, you can buy an entire case of any of the other brands' cards. So you can get a 24-pack case of wax packs for Topps, for Fleer, for Donruss, for Score, for Bowman. And sure, you know what? You're going to have tens of thousands of cards that you would pull from that. Like, let's say an 89 Topps case. And I like 89 Topps. That was the first set I collected. It's talking about connections to sets from the past. I will always have a soft spot for 89 Topps, even though the entire set may be book value, what, $12, $15, something like that. So you do the math there. You've got 24 boxes with 36 packs with 15 cards each. And lots and lots and lots of bricks of 30-year-old bubblegum inside of them. Yes, you've got tens of thousands of cards. And yes, with 89 Topps, you'll be able to pull a Craig Biggio and, all right, Brady Anderson. And, okay, Tom Glavine and John Smoltz and early career cards for Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens and Kirby Puckett, and then your big star cards. You've got your Cal Ripken Jr., your Ricky Henderson, your George Brett's, all of these guys. And you may, when everything's said and done, when you've torn through this entire case of cards you've spent $150 for, you may have $150 in star cards. You may have an entire stack, 1,000 of these cards. But 1,000 of these cards collectively are valued at $150. But the money you spent on that one box of Upper Deck cards to get that one card that at a minimum you can price at $150. You know, if you don't go through the grading process, you could probably sell it for $150. That's why there's more of a push for the packs and the boxes. Because not only is there a chance of getting that extra one or two Griffey cards, but also because that one card is going to be so much more valuable than everything else that comes out of a case of Topps Wax or any of the other sets that were released that year. You also asked, are they being stocked away as investments since these boxes only seem to go up? Yes. The 1989 Upper Deck Griffey Jr. card, while a lot of people back 30 years ago thought that this would be the next 52 Mantle, well, obviously it's not, because one thing that made the 52 Mantle so valuable is the fact that so many kids abused their cards or mom threw them out. You know, there's a scarcity to 52 Topps. Hell, Topps threw out their own cards. It's a well-known story of Cy Berger ordering the warehouses cleared out of all this excess, product that they couldn't sell in 1952 and dumping it off the coast of New York. So, you know, even Topps got rid of the original cards. Clearly, Upper Deck was not going to do that in 1989. And I know there's a conspiracy theory, and somebody actually put it out there. I think it was Nathan McNeely actually said that there was a conspiracy theory that Upper Deck had actually, you know, created extra number of cards to pump up the value of these, which is actually how it goes counter to reality. You short print them to create the hype. Upper Deck, to my knowledge, didn't do that. They were up and up on the actual cards that were printed and distributed. But because of all those other sets from 1989, pretty static in price. Not going to say that, you know, the sets or the cards or the boxes will go down in value because they are 30 years old. That is technically a collector's item. But the Upper Deck card, with the limited numbers that they were running, plus the run for the Griffey Jr. cards, those packs and those boxes, I won't say will continue to climb to great heights over the years, but now that you're at 30 years, now that Griffey's a Hall of Famer, now that this is arguably the most sought-after card from the 1980s, there's always going to be a premium value assigned to that factory set, that box, and those packs, as well as the individual card. But again, the chance to get more than one through one of those other means, other than buying that separate card, will continue to keep that price up there. Now, can you imagine if Ken Griffey Jr. bombed as a player? What if Ken Griffey Jr. was DJ Dozier and we didn't know any better? That's a great what if. You want to talk about a Michael Knight alternative universe episode here of baseball card history. What if Ken Griffey Jr. bombed as a player, was nowhere near as good as he should have been? Would the 89 Upper Deck set be, I don't want to say a failure, but you clearly wouldn't have the aftermarket value like you do now for that set 30 years later. I think it would be very similar to an 88 score set, or, you know, maybe some of the early Fleer and Donruss sets, not from 81, but, you know, some of the better sets from 83 and 84 that had a little more star power and was better quality than what was initially produced. That's a great what-if question. What if Ken Griffey Jr. fizzled as a player and there was no huge dollar Griffey rookie card in the 89 Upper Deck set? You know, Griffey may have gotten you a few bucks back then, but not quite, you know, setting the market to where it was. Like, I remember as a kid, the Griffey card was $50 out of the pack. And this was 2 years after it was released. I mean, can you imagine if Griffey failed and they didn't have that card to kind of build the story of the company on? We'd be looking at Upper Deck a whole lot differently now if that happened. And in fact, the Upper Deck company, which follows us on Wax and Gum Stains, thanks for listening, but the Upper Deck company may not be in business anymore if they didn't have the legend of the Ken Griffey Jr. card number one, to kind of carry the mail through the early years. As, you know, they had a great product too, and it did raise the bar, as we'll discuss, but just imagine if they didn't have that first card. That's a fun what if to put out there. One last comment from Wax and Gum Stains, and this goes off our conversation about the grocery cards from the 1980s, in particular the Ralston Purina Gary Carter card that I had that referenced Donkey Kong cereal, one of the many cereals that you could get your free baseball card in. We have a listener here with a very lengthy name. I'm just going to say, but what is the first two words of his 80 character name here? He says, Donkey Kong cereal was pretty good, to be honest, similar to Cap'n Crunch from what I remember. And there's a reason why I didn't eat Donkey Kong cereal back in 1984. First, my parents didn't buy it. Second, I can already tell you what it tasted like. And yeah, it probably did taste like Cap'n Crunch, because any quote unquote limited edition cereal that is often based on whatever is hot in the market now is either tasting like Cap'n Crunch or it's basically Lucky Charms, just with different shaped marshmallows. That's about it. So the next time you go to the grocery store and you buy that box of Frozen 2 cereal because your four-year-old daughter just has to have Frozen 2 cereal, and you're whipping out $4.50 for that stinking cereal, it's basically just Lucky Charms. Just buy your Lucky Charms and say, this is Frozen 2, and here's the evil leprechaun from the movie. You don't remember him because you went out to the bathroom with your mother. It was a very short part of the movie. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. So thanks to everybody who contributed with some great questions and some memories as well. And make sure you tell your friends about Wax and Gum Stains. It is open 24/7. We look forward to the conversation with them, and we look forward to continued conversation with you as we look to answer questions that you may have, offer up show ideas. You can do that as well. In fact, through our donation, one of our PayPal donations, the one that came from Marsha asking about the 30s through 50s cards, can we do some more shows about them? Yes, Marsha, certainly will do my best to find some more of those cards. But you can make those show requests and ideas like the birth year set via Wax and Gum Stains. And of course, just talk about the hobby, the players we discuss on the show, the cards itself. We certainly appreciate all commentary, questions, suggestions, you name it. And don't forget, too, if the platform you listen on, in particular Apple Podcasts, but other platforms have this capability as well, if you are able to provide any feedback on the program, whether it's rating it or writing a review, please do so and be honest. I certainly think we have a good show here, and I hope you leave some positive remarks, but be honest and, you know, go ahead and rate the program. Because the more people who rate it, and obviously the higher marks we get for it, helps push the promotion through the algorithm that Apple Podcasts and all these other programs use, helps push it up the you might be interested in list. So people who listen to other sports cards or sports podcasts, they'll see this one get nudged up into their suggestion list. So if you haven't already, please do rate and or review Wax Ecstatic on the platform that you listen to. All right, let's talk a little bit about 89 Upper Deck. Like I said, if you go back in our archives, episode 28, way back from October of 2016, we've got the full story of how Upper Deck happened. And it's still a fascinating story. And Darren Rovell told the story back on ESPN's website back many, many years ago. I'm trying to think when they, like, 2002, 2003. But anyways, it's such an entertaining story of how Upper Deck not only got formed, but how it became such a smash hit out of the gate. And again, we didn't know the repercussions. We didn't know the ripple effect that Upper Deck would have in its revolutionary tactics within the hobby. But the backstory, the abbreviated version of the backstory, goes back to November of 1987, in the area near Anaheim Stadium, of course, now Angel Stadium, where the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, formerly the California Angels, have been playing since 1966. Well, a relief pitcher for the Angels by the name of Dwayne Bice. You may remember Dwayne Bice. You probably mispronounced his name over and over again if you pulled his card. B-U-I-C-E. And that's Dwayne with the E between the D and the W. Dwayne Bice, a relief pitcher for the Angels, one night is hungry. He's looking for some Chinese food. He can't find the Chinese restaurant that he's trying to order from. But he does find a hobby shop in the same vicinity as where this Chinese restaurant is supposed to be. The hobby shop is called The Upper Deck. So Dwayne Bice walks into The Upper Deck, and he catches up with the store owner, Bill Hemrick. Now, as it would turn out, Hemrick not only provides Bice with directions to the Chinese restaurant he's looking for, but Bice is also a collector. So he spends a little time in there looking around and talking to the owner. Well, because Bice plays for the Angels and he's just stumbled upon this hobby shop, Now he's going back with regularity, and over the next few months, he strikes up a friendship with Hemric, and Hemric kind of opens the door to Bice on a little project that he's working on. He and his partner, Paul Sumner, were going to create a brand new trading card. And of course, we all know how the trading card turns out, but let's again remember, this is, by this point in time, the spring of 1988. What was the hobby like? Remember, spring of 1988, you've got Score rolling out their first set, which was very good. We covered it just a few episodes ago. You had the granddaddy of them all, Topps, putting out an underrated set that I've really come around to appreciate since then. Fleer put out a pretty good set, and Donruss, while it was a visually appealing set for most people, of course, 88 Donruss becomes the redheaded stepchild of the junk wax era because there's so much of it out there. And the 88 baseball card set is a little bit of a letdown from 1987. Not only do you have great designs of sets from 87, and that's all three of the big sets then, Topps, Donruss, and Fleer, but you also had a really stellar rookie class. You had Barry Bonds. You had Jose Canseco. You had Mark McGwire. You had Bo Jackson. You have this other generation of stars from the early to mid 80s, names I've already mentioned in this podcast. So the 87 sets are just, even then, kind of laying the foundation for legendary status. All three of the sets that were produced then were outstanding. 88 comes around, and even though Score's debut is good, the other cards can't quite live up to what they were in 87. And of course, there is a limited, lesser rookie crop from 1988. Really, the big rookie cards of 1988 are guys like Rafael Palmeiro and Tom Glavine and Roberto Alomar, all good players. You've got some Hall of Famers in there too, but not quite Bo and Jose and Bonds, all these other big names here. So there could be some improvements to the hobby in 1988, and who better to ask about improving the product than people who sell it? And that's what Hemric and Sumner did. They sold it. They saw some problems. They wanted to correct it with their own card. Now, this is nothing new. As we've brought up before, the TCMA cards of the 1970s, those were a couple of hobby shop dealers in New York City that created a card that they thought was better than what Topps was producing. And Topps, of course, met them in court and said, you can't do that. Well, things were a lot different in the late 1980s. By then, Topps no longer had a monopoly. They had to have competition, but competition was a good thing, not just for the buyers and collectors of cards, not just for the retailers who were making money off of them, but Major League Baseball and the Players Association. By 1988, they realized, hey, we can make a lot of money if we get a percentage of the royalties of these cards by officially licensing them for the league and for the players. So that's part of why the junk wax era even began. What started as just Topps and became Topps, Fleer, and Donruss very quickly became six or seven or eight brands that were out there. And nobody wanted to stop it, because even a brand like Bowman, which of course was a subsidiary of Topps, even a brand like Bowman that didn't sell that many cards or wasn't as popular in the early days, still, revenue is revenue. If money is coming in, and it doesn't cost Major League Baseball or their Players Association a dime to produce these cards. If anybody took a hit financially, it was Topps, or it was the retailer who maybe bought too much and couldn't sell enough of them at the counter. So the players and the league, they're totally fine with what's going on here because they're just raking in the dough in the late 80s and early 90s. But that was the key to getting a card company started. You had to have access to either Major League Baseball or the Players Association to get your product officially licensed, approved, and promoted. And of course, anybody thinks they can make a good baseball card, and you know, anybody's going to line up at the doors of the offices of MLB or the MLBPA. So you have to have that in. Well, very quickly, Hemric and Sumner realized Dwayne Bice was their in. So Dwayne Bice was recruited to get this card in front of the MLBPA to get their approval, and then it would, you know, in full circle, get approved by Major League Baseball, and then you would have a card. So that is what Dwayne Bice was able to do. He secured the license, got a 12% stake in the card company, and he was also the subject of a demo card that was produced in 1988. It looks eerily similar to the 89 Upper Deck set. There were, I think, three demo cards that were produced, but Bice was one of them, and he basically used this card to get everyone's attention. And the Upper Deck guys, the owners of the shop, that of course being Hamrick and Sumner, came up with some ingenious ideas. Some that were, as I've mentioned before, not all that different from what Score was doing. That, of course, Score had the tamper-resistant packaging. Now, Score had the flimsy plastic, while Upper Deck would go with the foil wrapping. Score also had the full-color photograph on the back of the card in 1988. Not the first time we've had photos on the backs of cards. Topps did it in 1971. Fleer did it from 1983 to 85. So nothing new there, but the full color card and often an action shot on the back of the card. That was brand new for Upper Deck. Score used basically mug shots of the players, not action shots. And the Upper Deck photo on the back would take up about half the card or maybe two-fifths of the card, while even though Score used a bigger picture on the back of the card, that was still only about 20%, and it was just kind of nestled in the corner of the back of the card. So even though Score used those in 1988, the Upper Deck guys decided to improve it just a little more, and then they added some more bells and whistles, including the random sequencing, which I talked about, which cuts down on duplicates. Every time you opened up a pack, you were pretty much guaranteed to get a different assortment of cards, and not just from one pack next to another, but if you had 10 packs, then the likelihood of dupes was greatly eliminated. Also eliminated short print cards or double print cards, as the case may be. And they put in the holograph sticker. This was to reduce the counterfeit cards. It was a lot easier to counterfeit baseball cards, your standard ink and cardboard card that was created in the 1980s. And you had the better card stock. You had a slight gloss to the card stock. It wasn't just your standard picture and ink on cardboard like some of the other guys had. And you didn't just have a sticker like Fleer would put out for much of the 1980s. You had the hologram sticker. So hologram technology, not just used to prevent counterfeiting on these cards, but also as a nice little bonus that was put in there. So why just have a logo sticker of your favorite baseball team when you had the cool 3D effect of a hologram, as that technology became a little more affordable later on in the 80s? So all sorts of neat things to hook people. And one that I didn't notice until now, I never noticed it. It took me 30 years to notice this. And maybe it's because I didn't buy a lot of packs of Upper Deck in 1989. Again, I started collecting in 89, and Upper Deck was well out of my price range for a 12-year-old kid back then. So I didn't notice it until I bought these packs. But if you look closely at the front of a Upper Deck pack from 1989, there's a contest, and this is the low series, by the way, not the high series, because this was a contest that expired on July 4th, 1989. You could win a Mickey Mantle rookie card. As the wrapper says, worth thousands of dollars. And if you read the wrapper, here's what you did. You had to write in, this is before the days of email, of course, you had to write in, you know, self-addressed, stamped, and, envelope, sending it out to the Upper Deck people. You had to make a prediction on what the All-Star Game's final score would be. The All-Star Game played in Anaheim Stadium in 1989. You had to make a prediction, and then one winner who predicted the score correctly would be chosen, and that winner would get the Mickey Mantle rookie card. Now, that seems like a pretty neat contest just to begin with. And certainly if you ran a similar contest these days, if somebody said, I'll give you a Mickey Mantle rookie card if you guess the final score of the All-Star Game, well, sure, you're going to have tens of thousands of people responding to that just for a chance to get that card. But what makes this story so amazing is you have to remember, Upper Deck wasn't making Mickey Mantle rookie cards in 1952. This was Topps. The Upper Deck guys were using a competitor's product to promote the sale of their own product. That takes balls. Man, what chutzpah is that? Come buy our product, and we might just give you this really valuable card that was made by the other guys 37 years ago. How cool is that? That takes some real nerve right there. But again, you know, these guys, they own their own hobby shop, so it wasn't that hard to obtain one of these cards. It wasn't that hard to get insurance on it. It wasn't that hard to give it away, because they knew even if that 52 Topps card was worth, let's say, $3,000 back in 1989, they would make up for it with the sale of just a few cases of the Upper Deck cards. But I just thought that was so cleverly ingenious and kind of a backhanded slap at the competition. Come buy our cards. They're better. They're counterfeit proof. They're valuable. They've got holograms in them. They're tamper resistant. You can't counterfeit them. And you just might win one of these other guys' cards. Isn't that kind of neat? Wow, what a deal. I love it. Absolutely love it. Now, of course, as we know, the hobby changes completely. Upper Deck becomes incorporated in 1988, and at the end of the 88 season, they receive their licensing, so they are ready to make cards in 1989. And the rest, as they say, is history. We all know how it goes from here, where Upper Deck just takes the hobby by storm. Out goes the toys, even though Upper Deck would continue to produce the hologram stickers for a couple more years. Inserts became a premium. They were the first to include autographed cards, the Ted Williams subset, the Reggie Jackson subset, the Nolan Ryan subsets in the early 1990s. They created the autographed search for cards in the early 1990s. Of course, and I've mentioned this before, the base sets. No longer could you just put out a set of 700 or 800 cards. You had to have premium card stock. You had to have a great design. You had to have big, impactful rookies. And that again goes to how important it was that Upper Deck had Ken Griffey Jr. as card number one, and the fact that Upper Deck was very fortunate to have Ken Griffey Jr. be successful. Upper Deck wasn't the only company to include Ken Griffey Jr. in their set, in their base set. Donruss had Ken Griffey Jr. in 1989. Bowman had Ken Griffey Jr. in 1989. I believe Score had Ken Griffey Jr. as well. But because it was the premier edition, because it was card number one, and because you have that unforgettable pose, which we learned years later, they airbrushed the Mariner cap on, but with a state-of-the-art Photoshop system back then. Because it was such an iconic look that matched Griffey's personality, that rookie card, head and shoulders, far more impactful than any of the other rookie cards. Fleer had a rookie card for Ken Griffey Jr. that year as well. Topps, for some strange reason, held on to it until the rookie and update set, the Topps traded set, if you will, in 1989. So it's just amazing how this whole new product just takes the market by storm. And there was an instant effect. All of a sudden, people were spending their money on the premium card. There was the chase for the Griffey Jr. card. There was the chase for the Dale Murphy inverted negative card. And that's still a sought-after card these days, or the corrected version. I forget which one is worth more. And there was that short-term effect, but the long-term effect also kicking in. In 1990, in 1991, Upper Deck is eating the lunch of all these other card manufacturers because they keep pushing out relatively an unchanged product. Even though the hobby has grown, even though the demands from collectors has changed, they're just kind of pushing out the same thing year after year after year. But Upper Deck keeps raising the bar to where the other companies had to release premium sets to counter what Upper Deck was doing. Of course, you had Leaf come out in 1990 with some nice cards. Fleer Ultra failed with their premium set in 91, but rebounded in 92. Topps Stadium Club came up with the ultimate answer to what Upper Deck was producing, and in fact, kind of pushed back on Upper Deck. Like, Upper Deck then had to out-Upper Deck themselves several years later to counter the new Stadium Clubs and Fleer Ultras and all the others. And of course, the prices go up. It eliminates part of the audience that can buy the pricier cards and leads to a fracturing in the hobby. Now, I'm not going to say that Upper Deck is ultimately responsible for the collapse of the baseball card industry in the mid to late 90s, but the first fracture was Upper Deck with the price structure, with the caste system now of baseball cards vis-a-vis collectors. You would have others along the way. You had the premium versus base set fracture. You had the insert subsets versus the regular card fracture. You had the refractor fracture. You had the game-used equipment. You had the autograph fractures. You had all these other mini fractures, but this was the first boom that came down and started spreading all the little fissures everywhere. So while Upper Deck made an immediate impact in 1989, the ultimate impact to what it would do to the hobby, you didn't really realize it until maybe about 5 or 6 years later. So that's what I'm talking about, that delayed revolution. Facebook is a great example of it. Starts up in 2004, 2005, really doesn't grab hold of things until around 2009. And then now they're an unstoppable machine. And there's a lot of bad with that good. Same thing with Upper Deck. The changes that they instituted into the hobby, while some were very good on their own, collectively, there were some bad trends that came out of it. And ultimately, the whole hobby just ends up getting saturated and the values just collapse in the late 90s. And it took a good 10, 15 years really for the hobby to rebound. And there's still some love for the 89 Upper Deck set, but there were some casualties along the way, including Dwayne Bice. In fact, Bice had a very messy breakup with the Upper Deck people. I don't want to get too detailed in it, but basically, and this happens with any venture that becomes more successful or more popular than anyone could have imagined. Somebody wants a little more money out of it, so you had a very nasty financial squabble between these parties, and they came to a settlement and got that out of the way. But Upper Deck is no longer producing baseball cards. That ended in 2005 when Topps signed the first of many exclusivity deals with Major League Baseball and the Players Association. However, Upper Deck is still putting out cards, and they are the official hockey card of the National Hockey League. So if you're a hockey fan and you've been collecting cards, you can't get the Topps and the OPGs like you used to back in the day. Now it's all Upper Deck. So they certainly still have their finger on the pulse of the collecting and the sports card hobby, just not quite to the extent that they did 30 years ago when they rolled out the initial product. So 89 Upper Deck, we've talked a lot about the card design itself, which is always fascinating. I brought this up in the video, but if you look at the Upper Deck card, if you angle it just a little bit and treat the lower right corner as home base or home plate, rather, 89, you have the baseline from home plate to first base. The 1990 set, there's a line across the top that kind of represents second base. 91, you had third base and around to home plate in the lower right. That's where the team logos went. So in the first 3 years, you kind of had this facsimile baseball diamond that was created out of the design of the front of the cards. And as I've mentioned before, too, with Stadium Club and Fleer Ultra and all the other, Leaf Studio, all the other prominent sets, the premium sets that came out in the mid-90s, Upper Deck had to change, too. And you look back at the 89 design, which, again, was groundbreaking in 1989, it actually looks not all that different from what some of the other companies were doing back then or would continue to do for a couple of years. It wasn't until 1993 that Upper Deck got rid of the borders, and then you had the more common practice of pretty much a full glossy all photograph, minimalistic design for the fronts and the backs of the cards. So even Upper Deck had to adjust along the way. But they had a lot of success, made a lot of money, especially those first 5 or 6 years. And it's not often you can say one particular card or one particular company changes how everyone else does something. But in the event of an Apple computer company, in the event of Microsoft, in the event of Facebook or Southwest Airlines, all those other examples I brought up, sometimes you have that one company that makes all the difference. And sometimes it's that one person. You know, you think of the people that were integral in making the change happen. You think of Steve Jobs, and you think of Bill Gates, and you think of Herb Keller, who was a lawyer behind the Southwest growth, and you think of Mark Zuckerberg. Well, for the Upper Deck Company, yeah, you have the store owners, but if it wasn't for Dwayne Bice getting lost looking for Chinese food one night in Anaheim, California, and happening to stumble into the Upper Deck hobby shop, you may not have an Upper Deck baseball card these days. Or maybe you would have, but it would have been delayed a few years. And again, this is a fun what if. And I'm going to put it on Wax and Gum Stains. I want to hear your reaction to it. What would the 89 Upper Deck set be today if Ken Griffey Jr. was not a Hall of Famer? And I don't mean, you know, like a, you know, Dwight Evans borderline Hall of Famer stuff. No, I mean, what if Ken Griffey Jr.'s career, what if Ken Griffey Jr. was Todd Van Poppel, non-pitcher version, of course. But like I said, you know, what if he was DJ Dozier or Hensley Mullins? You know, you can come up with all sorts of rookies that didn't pan out. Kevin Moss, all right? A lot of hype behind those guys. Joe Charbonneau, if you want to go a little more old school. What if Ken Griffey Jr. had that rookie excitement, but his big league career was pretty much said and done 5, 6, 7 years later? What would the 89 Upper Deck set be today if that was the case? And would it be as well remembered, as well regarded, as game changing as we know it today? Because remember, other card sets had the Griffey rookie in it, and they're still valuable. You can get a Donruss or a Fleer rookie for Griffey for, you know, several bucks. You can value those at. But if his career didn't turn into what it was, if his personality wasn't what it was, if he wasn't the face of the Seattle Mariners for the next, 10 years, what would the 89 set be like? Completely different world in the hobby. I can definitely say that. Completely different, be upside down from what we know it as. A couple other quick notes about the 89 Upper Deck set. There's a great feature on one of the designers of the card done by the Beckett Company a few years ago. And just some fascinating facts behind the set, including why they chose Ken Griffey Jr. as the number one card. He seemed to be destined for success. And again, they were very fortunate that that is indeed how it turned out. But also why the rookie cards were the first 26 cards, 27 if you include the checklist. Why the rookie cards were the first subset within the set. He described it as, you know, if somebody was opening a factory set, they could basically just take out the first 27 cards, put it in one of those little plastic card holders and sell that subset separately if they wanted to, because there was such a craze for rookie cards back in 1989. Still is, but, you know, it was really at the peak of its craze, I would think, back in the late 80s. Also, in case you were wondering why the rookie cards only had one picture on them, didn't have any pictures on the back, it was just statistical information. It was because this designer, by the way, Tom Guidman is his name, he was not only a designer, but actually assembled the checklist for Upper Deck in the early days. One reason why the rookie cards only had one picture on them was because they didn't have access to a lot of pictures. You know, they didn't get the approval to produce a product until the end of 1988. Well, the season's over. You can't find any more action shots of these rookie players. So they often just had to use what they had, and they didn't always have great pictures of these players. So the 89 rookies set, the star rookies that came out, is a very minimalistic set if you look at the design. And there's a great story behind card number 3. So there is a rookie in the Pirates organization named Tony Chance. Tony Chance was not Upper Deck's top choice for the Pirates rookie. And it also turned out that he just didn't have much of a career. So on top of he didn't have a long career and his picture wasn't that good, and it's not a very good looking card, that to the Upper Deck design people was an absolute dud. In every way possible, that Tony Chance card represented how bad a card could go. And nothing against Tony Chance here, but they basically dedicated card number 3 to the player that they didn't really like every year. So the one rookie that they thought really didn't have a chance, or they didn't like the selection of the rookie representing the team, that would be card number 3 year after year. So as he pointed out, Tom Dreese had the honor in 1990, DJ Dozier in 1991, Brian Jordan later on 1993. So the number 3 card in Upper Deck was intentionally supposed to be a dud. And also, card number 666. Of course, we know what the number 666 means to a lot of people. The mark of the beast, the satanic number, the devil number. Well, Upper Deck got their revenge, at least in the 1989 set, of card number 666. With these guys, most of them being Angels fans because they were in Anaheim and they did not like the Dodgers, they devoted card number 666 in the 1989 set to Kirk Gibson, Dodger hero from game 1 of the 88 World Series. And it's an 88 World Series subset card. And they decided to put the Gibson card at 666. So some neat little jokes inside there in the first Upper Deck set. Now, it will cost you a lot more to track down packs and boxes, but the thrill of potentially getting that Griffey card is all the reason why I think it's a pretty good idea to go ahead and spend a few extra bucks. I'm all about bargains. And yeah, if you can get more bang for your buck and get some good boxes or good packs or good single cards for just a couple dollars, pennies on the dollar to what they used to be in book value, that's great. Well, all that money that you save from all the other advice that I've given you on how to get your Fleer Ultra boxes cheap, or how to get your 88 Tops boxes cheap, et cetera, et cetera. I hope all those pennies and dimes and dollar bills that you've saved, you've collected them, go ahead and splurge and get some 89 Upper Deck. Because even if you don't get the rookie card for Ken Griffey Jr., you will at least have the very beginning of a beautiful set, a game changer, and a game changer in both short and long term for both good and bad. And I'm always up for having a piece of history. That's why I buy those cards from the 40s and the 50s, and they're in terrible condition, not because I'm going to resell them, but because I've got a piece of history in my hand. Same thing with 89 Upper Deck. Yes, I got a buttload of checklist cards in the packs that I bought, but it's neat to have the other cards, the other 50 or so cards of actual players, even though I only really got one huge star player there, Cal Ripken Jr. in the set. It's a nice little foothold. It's a nice little, roughly 8% of a complete set. And because of the random sequencing that Upper Deck had in 1989, the more packs you buy, the less likely you'll end up with a stack of duplicates in them. Now, let's take a look briefly at the 4 players that I pulled from the packs here. And one of the downsides of doing random pulls is sometimes you get guys that don't have much of a backstory. And I've got 2 of those. It's just pure chance. Again, I pulled these cards. And doing a little research, I couldn't find a whole hell of a lot on a couple players. One of them I pulled simply because it's not card number 1 in the 89 Upper Deck set. It's card number 2. And I thought it would be fun to see what happened to Luis Medina, who was an Indians prospect. Card number 2. So thanks to the random sequencing, I didn't land the Griffey Jr. rookie, but I did get the Medina rookie card here. And I guess the best thing you can say about Luis Medina is there was that song about him, Funky Cold Medina. That's about it, basically. As Luis Medina, not to be confused, as he is not related to the Yankees prospect of today with the same name, but Luis Medina was a draft pick of numerous teams in the early 1980s. Get this. He was born in Santa Monica, California, and was obviously a standout in high school and later Cerritos College in Norwalk, California, because he was drafted by the Mets in the 33rd round of the 81 draft. He didn't sign with them. So he was drafted again by the Mets in the January secondary draft of 82. Doesn't sign with them. Drafted by the Yankees in the third round of the secondary June draft in 82. Doesn't sign with them. Drafted by the Reds in the second round of the 83 January secondary draft. Doesn't sign with them. Drafted by the A's in the third round of the 83 June secondary draft. Doesn't sign with them. Drafted by the Astros in the first round of the 84 June secondary draft. Doesn't sign with them. And then finally, after his time at Cerritos College and later Arizona State, he finally is drafted and signs with the Indians after they picked him in the ninth round of the 85 amateur draft. Once he does make his way to the big leagues, he has a little more than a cup of coffee. He did spend parts of several seasons up there. 16 games in 1988, where he hit 255. 30 games in 1989, where he hit 205. So you can see why Upper Deck put him in that rookie set. Maybe there was a chance that this youngster, who was a first baseman, outfielder, designated hitter, you know, just kind of a platoon guy on a pretty bad Indians team, there was a chance that maybe he could turn into a regular role player. Well, that didn't happen in 89. In fact, would go back to the minor leagues in 1990 and would have his last sniff at the big leagues in 1991, where he appeared in just five games. So his career numbers read 51 games played, 163 plate appearances, career batting average of .207, and a career fielding record, a percentage of, wasn't that bad here, total .987. But he was really more of a pinch hitter and designated hitter and had very few opportunities out in the field. After he was let go from the Indians following the 1991 season, he would sign as a free agent with the Kansas City Royals. Never played for the Royals in Kansas City, however, is still affiliated with them. At last check, and I was able to track this information down, Luis Funky Cold Medina is a special assistant to the general manager in Kansas City. Somewhat of a similar story with another card that I randomly pulled. Now, I'll be honest, I pulled this card because the back photograph is so good. The colors pop from the road uniform of Jeff Parrott, who at that time was a pitcher for the Montreal Expos. Now, the funny thing is, when the 89 season started, he wasn't playing for the Expos anymore. He had already been traded to the Philadelphia Phillies. In fact, December of 1988, along with Floyd Youmans, goes to Philadelphia for Kevin Gross. And he would be in Philadelphia for a year and a half. Jeff Parrott, best known as one of the many pieces in the Dale Murphy trade with Atlanta, as it was Parrott along with Jim Vacher and Victor Rosario going to Atlanta for Dale Murphy and Tommy Green. And you may remember Tommy Green, and one of the few positive things to come out of his playing career, he would actually throw a no-hitter for the Phillies in 1991, I believe. He also appeared in the 93 World Series, if memory serves correct. While Parrott would also appear in the postseason, he was part of the Atlanta Braves team in 1991, although I don't believe he saw any action in the 91 postseason. Later on, he would sign with the Oakland Athletics as a free agent and was part of the A's final playoff team of that juggernaut time of the late 80s and early 90s, 1992. They would lose to Toronto in the ALCS. Signed as a free agent with the Colorado Rockies prior to the 1993 season. He was a member of the expansion Rockies, their inaugural team. And then basically from that point on, bounced around from team to team to team, signing as a free agent, first with Kansas City, later with St. Louis, and then Philadelphia before calling it a career in November of 1996. And his stat line has a 56-43 record, 3.80 earned run average as well. A career that saw him go through Montreal, Philly, Atlanta, Oakland, Colorado, St. Louis, and Philly once again over the course of 10 years. So that's all I've got for Jeff Parrott. Now we've got a little more information about some of the other players. The two that I've got here, first, Jim Whalewander. Now I've called him for years Wallowander because that's the 10-year-old in me. I want to call the guy Wallowander, but it is Jim Whalewander. And his nickname was Whales. And Jim Whalewander, our fans listening in the Detroit area will remember Jim Whalewander, even though his major league career very short. He played 162 games over the course of four seasons, was primarily a pinch hitter and pinch runner, and that's because he was drafted as a second baseman with the Detroit Tigers. And much like if you were a shortstop drafted by the Baltimore Orioles in the 1980s, you had no chance of seeing any significant playing time with the Orioles. You hoped that you were traded at some point so that you had a chance to make it to the major leagues. Well, likewise, as long as you had Alan Trammell and Lou Whitaker right up the middle at Tiger Stadium, you had very little chance of seeing significant playing time. But Sparky Anderson would find a way to work Jim Whalewander into the equation every now and then in 1987 and 88. In fact, Whalewander scored the game-winning run in the penultimate game of the 87 season. Blue Jays fans, we don't like that one. That was where, of course, the Tigers overcame the Blue Jays in the American League East standings to win the division on the last day. So Whalewander, an interesting little footnote in that story there. He had his own fan club that would often travel to nearby cities such as Cleveland or Toronto or Chicago. He was a Chicago native, so he had a lot of family there that supported him as well. He had his own song, and he was also apparently a big punk rock fan. He was a big fan of the Dead Milkmen. And that is neat in and of itself. If you like the Dead Milkman and you're a guy by the name of Jim Whalewander and you have your own fight song, you've got a good thing going here. Now, after his time in Detroit, he would become a free agent, signing with the New York Yankees, later the Texas Rangers, the Angels, and the Florida Marlins after the 1993 season, although his big league career ended in 93 with the Angels. So all in all, 141 games with Detroit, 12 with the Angels, 9 with the Yankees, and a career batting average of .215. But also lots of runs scored, 50 runs scored, because he was speedy on the base paths and could be counted on in a pinch running or sometimes pinch hitting situation. Now, whatever happened to Jim Whalewander? Well, all I can tell you is Whalewander went back to Arizona State University, got an MBA from the UCLA Anderson School of Management, and is probably picking up lots of dollars somewhere, even though he couldn't make it in the major league, certainly made it after the fact. And lastly, I picked this card because every card that I've ever had of Terry Leitch, it's always of him in the middle of a pitch, and Terry Leitch had such an unusual delivery. It was kind of this hybrid of a sidearm underhand delivery. Every time that the picture was taken, it was mid-delivery. So every picture I have of Terry Leitch on a card features his body in a very strange, contorted fashion. And it has always stuck out all these years later. And Terry Leitch actually has a very interesting story, not just because of his career, but because of his delivery. Now, he went to Auburn University, but I won't hold that against him. And sometime when he was at Auburn in the late 70s, he blew out his arm, and there's many reasons to think, well, after the fact, that he actually tore ligaments in his shoulder and probably should have had his career done before it even started. But he was able to, once the pain went away and once it was, you know, basically in the short term corrected, he was able to pitch again with that unique sidearm delivery. And instead of becoming a velocity pitcher, was basically a junk ball pitcher. He could wow you with curveballs and sliders and the occasional Ephus pitch. And what made the 82-mile-an-hour curveball even more hard to hit was, again, that unique angle that it's coming from. It was very hard for hitters to pick up the pitch as he's releasing it. And speaking of releases, Terry Leach had quite a few through his career. Now, first of all, he was originally drafted by the Red Sox in January of 1976, but that pick was voided because there was some controversy in his age. He was actually too young to be drafted. So the Red Sox lose that pitch. He goes to Auburn, as I mentioned, and eventually signs with an independent league team, the Baton Rouge Cougars of the Gulf States League. And he didn't really have great numbers. He was 2-0, had a 6.16 earned run average in five games. Yet, that was good enough to be signed by the Atlanta Braves. And if you look at the Atlanta Braves pitching staffs in the late 1970s, yep, that was good enough to qualify as a member of the Atlanta Braves. So he gets into the Braves organization and is slowly working his way up through the minor leagues. And he is in Savannah in 1980, finds out that he is just cut loose from the Braves. He's picked up by the New York Mets. They were looking for some starting pitching in their minor league system, so he moves over there. Eventually, he finds his way up to the major leagues, makes his major league debut in August of 1981. Now, just like the Atlanta Braves of the late 1970s, the early 80s Mets are an absolute disaster. But that offers a guy like Terry Leach an opportunity here and there to get some playing time. So he makes that debut in 1981. In 1982, he's splitting time between the New York Mets and the Tidewater Mets. And in fact, had a one-hitter for the Mets, a 10-inning complete game, 1-0, one-hitter in 1981. And people are thinking, oh, this guy is coming around. He's going to be part of this young team that eventually starts winning in New York. Well, even though he had some bright moments in 1982, well, in comes George Bamberger with the Mets, and he doesn't like him, doesn't like how he's throwing, basically spends the entire 1983 season back in Tidewater. Well, eventually the Mets decide to give up on him. They trade him to the Cubs for prospects Jim Adamczak and Mitch Cook, two guys that clearly didn't make much of a mark with the Mets later on. So here we go in 1984. Looks like Terry Leach may be able to finally catch on with another organization, this time the Chicago Cubs. But just like with the Mets, you have another manager change. You've got the brand new manager in Chicago, Jim Frey, who's not a big fan of what Leach is doing. And he was very knee-deep in numbers as well. Leach didn't do extremely well against, I believe it was, left-handed hitters. So they decide to keep him in the minor leagues once again. So late in the 84 season, he gets traded to the Atlanta Braves for Ron Meredith. So here he is in the Braves organization once again, can't get up to the major leagues. He's stuck in AAA with Richmond for a while, gets released from the Braves, and re-signs with the Mets and goes back to Tidewater, and here we go all over again. So he starts improving his game. He becomes more of a relief pitcher. And in the middle of the 1986 season, Davey Johnson, who was his manager in Tidewater several years before, was able to bring him up and finally get Leach some sustained action in the big leagues. He had 22 appearances in 1985. Nothing spectacular with his numbers, but he was more than serviceable and was part of this resurgent Mets team. Well, even though he was a positive asset for the Mets in 85, at 32 years of age, he just doesn't fit into the Mets' plans for 1986. Remember, this is the young and upcoming team. Leach doesn't quite fit the mold here. So he's spending basically the entire season in Tidewater once again. Is a September call-up. However, he's called up injured, so he doesn't pitch for the Mets in the 86 playoffs or the World Series. And in fact, at first, did not receive a World Series ring. Now, he would finally get that ring in 1995. He was one of four players who at first was denied a ring by the Wilpon family. Go figure, the Wilpons being cheap with jewelry here. But finally, they were able to, he and the players were able to come to an agreement with the Wilpons to get that World Series ring, as long as one of the players, who was Randy Myers, split the cost with the Wilpons to fund the rings. So Terry Leitch does indeed have a World Series ring for the 86 Mets. Now, that wouldn't be the only ring he would get. More on that in just a moment. So 1987 comes around, and now he's finally found a spot with the Mets pitching staff in 1987. This is in part because Dwight Gooden is dealing with drug issues, the first of many times. Roger McDowell is on the disabled list at the beginning of the season. So 33-year-old Terry Leitch comes in, gets the opportunity to start pitching, and not only does well in relief, but actually goes 10-0 in his first 10 decisions. That is still a Mets franchise record. That's amazing. You consider Dwight Gooden and Tom Seaver and Jerry Kuzman and Nolan Ryan and now Noah Syndergaard. But it's Terry Leitch who owns the franchise record for most consecutive wins from the start of the season. That's just mind-blowing. Well, even though he eventually finishes 11-1 with a 3.22 earned run average, he has some knee surgery in the offseason and, you know, finds a role with the Mets in 88, but isn't able to stick around much longer. In fact, the Mets decide to move him in 1989 as they traded him to the Kansas City Royals in June of 89 for a player to be named later. That player would be Aguido Vasquez, who never made it to the major leagues. So now he's with Kansas City, doesn't really perform there. He's an overage guy with a team that is slowly declining in talent and victories. So at the end of the 89 season, he goes to sign with the Minnesota Twins. Now he signs a deal. I believe it was a two-year deal. Let me see here. No, I don't have that information on that first year of the contract. But anyways, he signs as a free agent. The 1990 Twins are an absolute dumpster fire, but it allows him to appear in the most games that he's ever played in a season. He appears in 55 games and puts up a respectable 3.20 earned run average, mostly all in relief throughout the 1990 season. Well, he hangs around. He's a bargain, you know, reacquisition for the Twins in 1991. Well, what do you know? He not only is part of the Twins season for much of the year, in fact, he appears in more than 50 games again, but he is also a participant in the 91 World Series, as he would pitch 2 1/3 innings over two games. Didn't do anything spectacular, however, was part of that World Championship team in 1991. So for a guy who kept getting cut and traded and released and moved around, finally finding a home with the Mets, but not for long, didn't at that time have a World Series ring, which he deserved, bouncing around with some bad teams in Kansas City and Minnesota. Now at the age of 37, he's a world champion. So quite the trail for Terry Leitch. It doesn't end there. He eventually signs as a free agent with the Montreal Expos, is released right before the start of the 92 season, signs on with the Chicago White Sox in 1993, does not participate in the White Sox American League Championship Series with the Blue Jays in 93, and then from then on, dealing with injuries, not being able to latch on anywhere. He was with the Detroit organization in 94, 95, eventually retired in 1996. Now, he would actually write an autobiography, a rather folksy autobiography. This is a Selma, Alabama native, Terry Leitch, and he co-authored a book called Things Happen for a Reason, The True Story of an Itinerant Life in Baseball. It was produced back in 2000 and is regarded by several literary followers as a hell of a read. I have not read it yet, but now I may actually track it down, because I can only imagine some of the stories that Terry Leitch has, particularly from the 1980s, where just when he thinks he's caught on in the early 80s with the Mets, and he doesn't, and he's going from organization to organization, can never get above AAA, finally gets a sniff in 86, can't get that World Series ring he's deserved. has a phenomenal 87, pretty decent 88 seasons, but is still kicked to the curb, and ultimately wins a World Series and, you know, actually plays in one in 1991. Quite the path for Terry Leach. So Terry Leach, more than just, a contorted body and some baseball cards in the late 80s and early 90s, but quite the traveling man, as Ricky Nelson would say. Well, we've traveled to the end of this podcast, and always when we're talking 89 Upper Deck, it seems to run a little long, but it was such an influential set in the history of sports card collecting that you have to pontificate a little bit or opine a little bit more on it. And why not? Because again, the short-term and the long-term effects of that set, both good and bad, have created a whole new hobby. And clearly the hobby would not be what it is today, and without a doubt wouldn't have reached the heights that it did, say, 25 years ago, had it not been for a relief pitcher for the California Angels stumbling into a card shop when he was on the lookout for Chinese food one night. And it's just amazing, again, had that chance meeting with Dwayne Bice and the owners of the Upper Deck Hobby Shop not happened. Had Ken Griffey Jr. not been the knockout stud rookie and eventual Hall of Famer that he would become, just amazing the different worlds that collide here with the 89 Upper Deck set. We may be talking about a completely different hobby, and that's not necessarily a great thing. It could have been a hobby that just kind of drifted along aimlessly and never reached heights that it did. But the Upper Deck creation and premiere set of 1989 was a big reason for why the hobby ended up where it did. And again, both good and bad. So 89 Upper Deck, even though I didn't get too many star cards, the Ripken Jr. card, the exception here, and I do have quite a few checklist cards out of this, would I go spend another $20 for another four or five packs? You better believe it. And even though it is a few more dollars than any other item that was made in 1989, it is, in my opinion, still worth the money. Even if you don't get any star cards, even if you don't get the Griffey card, you've got a little piece, a little slice of a very, very influential card set. And at 30 years later, it is still going strong, which can't be said for a lot of other sets or a lot of other cards that were made in the late 1980s. All right, that'll do it for this episode of Wax Ecstatic. My thanks to you for listening. Don't forget to chime in at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. Make those cash donations via PayPal, paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, paypal.me/waxecstatic. And make sure you join us in the new year. Our next show scheduled for Friday, January 2nd, 2020. We'll see you then. Have a Merry Christmas, a happy holiday season, and a Happy New Year as well.